Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of July 8th, 2011. It is not a compliment when someone says, you throw like a girl. But what if they say you invest like one?
Women tend to be more prudent rather than impulsive. They're patient. They're not reckless. So when I say you invest like a girl, that is a very good thing.
And guess who invests like a girl? Warren Buffett. And it turns out most of us have a skewed notion of financial safety online.
Actually, we would think that the credit card hacking is the most dangerous, but almost just as dangerous are just our username and passwords hacking.
We'll have tips for your online security. And Horrible Bosses hits movie theaters this weekend. Can you relate?
You've got to step back, take your emotions out of the equation, and try to figure out what you really can and can't live with.
One tip, don't hire a hitman. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Amid all the talk about raising the debt ceiling, you may hear some jokes about how China owns the United States. So, how about owning a little bit of China? Mutual fund managers are looking for more investments in growing economies like China, India, Brazil, and Russia. Why? Well, because that's where the money is. And so is the risk. And that means your mutual fund managers may not be playing things as safely as they used to. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has the story.
This time of year, your mailbox gets full with reports about how your 401k is doing. Most people don't look at them. I don't read them because I have all of 80 cents in my 401k. But when I got the report from the Oakmark funds, I looked at a little insert that fluttered out. It was bland, but the news was pretty big. Oakmark said it may change its strategy. It used to keep limits on how much money it invested in India, China, Russia, Brazil, and other countries that are called emerging markets. Now it's dropping those limits. It's not just Oakmark. Adam Bold, the CEO of the mutual fund store, says fund managers are sick of trying to scrape decent returns out of the slowing U.S. economy.
The fund manager is saying, hey, you know, these lines are getting blurred. We need to be able to go where the best stocks are, regardless of what the classification is. And we're seeing that as a trend throughout the industry.
I checked Oakmark's performance a few pages in. In the past 10 years, it failed to beat the market around 80% of the time. They lost even more ground in the financial crisis. And it looks like they want to take bigger risks to make better returns. They're doing it with my 80 cents and part of your 401k. It's easy to see why. Those emerging markets are growing fast, at around 6% a year. The U.S., on the other hand, is growing less than 2% a year. Here's Josh Brown. He's a financial planner in New York.
They're looking out longer term and they're saying, these are the next places that are going to be developed markets. That's the thesis why investors should be there.
Brown makes a good point. He says that here in the U.S., the middle class is getting squeezed. In countries like Brazil, China, and India, the middle class is growing. But here's a little history. Investors got burned before while chasing these returns. There was the tequila crisis in Mexico in 1995. Then there was the Asian flu. Then Brazil, Argentina, and Russia. The phrase, too big to fail, that wasn't about banks. That was about these countries. Here's Josh Brown again.
The risks are the same as they ever were. These are countries that are relatively new to democracy in some cases, and certainly to capitalism in all cases.
The difference is that before, banks bore the brunt. This was too exotic for mutual funds, so most regular people didn't get hurt. And now, the mutual funds may be too late. The really smart money has been going in this direction for years. There may not be many good deals left for the rest of us. There's also another big problem. It came to me when I was walking around my neighborhood in New York City. Jackson Heights is filled with Indian immigrants. They came to the U.S. to make more money, and they know the rules. But when mutual funds try to put their money in India, or China, or Russia, or Brazil, they don't know the rules. Accounting is different. Bribes are pretty common. Even the best investors get burned.
You have to make sure that you know what you own, which means you have to do on-the-ground research.
That's George Iwanicki. He comes up with investing ideas for J.P. Morgan's wealthiest clients. He says these countries can be profitable, but fund managers have to do their homework. They have to check for the rule of law. They have to hire people in those countries. And regular people have to check up on their mutual fund managers. Sure, naturally, that would be the right thing to do. But remember how we never read those reports? In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace Money.
There is a reason Warren Buffett is known as the Oracle of Omaha. He's a hugely successful investor who seems to be able to read the future. So what if I told you that one of the secrets of Buffett's success is his feminine tendencies, like patience and risk aversion? That is how author Lou Ann Lofton came to the theory of her new book, Warren Buffett Invests Like a Girl and Why You Should Too. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This book title is awfully provocative, but what it is very complimentary to girls.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when I say you invest like a girl, that's a good thing. Studies show that women tend to be more prudent rather than impulsive, and they're realistic rather than being overconfident. They're patient. They're not reckless. So when I say you invest like a girl, that is a very good thing.
And you actually told Warren Buffett that he invests like a girl, right? What was his response?
I did. Well, I felt pretty sure that he would, for one thing, get a kick out of it. And for another thing, I felt pretty sure he would take it as a compliment I intended it as. And he said, well, you'll have to read her book to see all the criteria that she uses. But I would say I probably plead guilty to that.
So how exactly do women invest? What are some of the characteristics of us that distinguish mm-hmm. us from our male counterparts?
Well, for one thing, we don't trade as much. We're more patient. We tend to buy and hold for the long term. We also are naturally more risk averse. That's something that's not only a characteristic of women when it comes to investing, but in other aspects of life. And we're actually better at managing our emotions than men are. I know that sounds controversial. Vanguard did a great study that showed when the market was tanking, when things were just at their bleakest back in the fall of 2008, beginning of 2009, women held. We did not panic and sell, whereas more men actually did sell at the very bottom of the market, the exact wrong time to do something like that.
So when we talk about the lack of testosterone, obviously Warren Buffett has plenty of that. So how do you draw the line between how he invests and how women invest? And how did he explain that to you?
Well, when you look at a guy like Buffett, what you really see is the exact opposite of what we've come to expect from Wall Street. He's not out there frantically trading. He's not driven by ego. He's not driven by this competitive desire to slaughter the guy in the cubicle next to him on the trading floor. And he's not taking a lot of risk. All those traits tend to actually be more feminine than they are masculine.
Well, in the book, you pull research from a number of scientific and psychological studies on male and female investors. Give us kind of a rundown of some of their main conclusions.
Yeah, there were several studies about hedge funds run by women that were pretty interesting. Well, for one thing, they showed that female-managed funds outperform male-managed funds. If you look at over the last 9 years, women-managed hedge funds outperformed male by 55%.
Whoa.
And they did it with styles that were more consistent. That is to say, they weren't constantly chasing the latest investment fad or the latest investment trend, the new hot thing. They were sticking with their knitting, essentially. Mm-hmm. They picked a style that worked for them, and they were therefore able to generate more consistent returns over time, which is really important when you're looking at past performance. You know, we always say it's not an indicator of future performance,
right.
But in this case, it actually is something you can point to.
Well, I have to ask, what kind of feedback have you gotten about this book from men in general? Are they not happy to see this? Do they understand it? Are they like, who are you to tell me? In other words, are they emotional about it?
They get very emotional, yes. I'm sorry to say, but they do. Of course, they all smirk about it initially. And then I've had several say, oh, you're right. You know, I am in the investment management industry. And I can tell you, after years of working with male clients versus female clients, they just do better. The females just get it better. Or they'll say, my wife, when she got involved in helping me make decisions for our family, when it comes to investing, our lot in life improved. And then there's the flip side of that, where I've certainly had men get very defensive.
How dare you?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, to them, my suggestion, honestly, is, okay, that's fine. That's fine if you don't want to invest like Warren Buffett. That's fine if you don't want to pattern yourself after the greatest investor the world's ever known. But mm-hmm. here's my suggestion. Buy the book for your wife. Buy the book for your daughter. And then in 3 years, when they're beating the pants off of your investment returns, it's okay. Sneak in the back room, pick it up, read it. We won't tell anybody.
The gauntlet has been thrown. I love that. Lou Ann Lofton is a writer and editor for The Motley Fool, and her new book is Warren Buffett Invests Like a Girl and Why You Should Too. I love this. Lou Ann, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Warren Buffett is also known for living a fairly ordinary lifestyle. He's been in the same modest home in Nebraska for decades, though admittedly he does have his own private jet. But he is not a spendthrift. You might even call him frugal. Now that's a word that's enjoyed something of a renaissance the last couple of years, but commentator Ramit Sethi wants you to forget what you've been told about the best way to save money.
Have you ever noticed that personal finance experts love lecturing Americans about what they can't do with their money? They say things like, stop spending money on lattes. You can't afford those jeans. Eating out? You should cook at home every night. Duh. The only problem is, these tips haven't worked for the last 50 years. Look at any indicator of debt or financial literacy, and you'll find that Americans are worse off year after year. Perhaps it's time for another approach. Instead of telling Americans about cutting back on everything, what about earning more? It turns out that when it comes to the two ways to grow your money, most Americans focus entirely on cutting back, but neglect the idea of earning more money. In my research, I discovered two main reasons we don't focus on earning more. First, we don't have an idea how we could earn more money. Second, we believe we don't have enough time. And so we focus on micro savings like cutting back on our morning latte, when eliminating it will only save us a few $100 per year. But the truth is, with 5 to 10 hours per week, most Americans have an existing skill that could earn them $1,000 a month on the side. For example, if you play a musical instrument, you could be a music instructor, often charging $25 an hour or more. If your house is meticulously organized, you could be a personal organizer, billing out at $75 an hour. Many of my readers charge very high rates, sometimes over $100 an hour, doing web design, PowerPoint creation, or IT consulting. In this economy, multiple revenue streams mean more security from a layoff. And since it's on the side, as you start to earn more, you can save it, pay off debt, spend it, or even decide to quit your job and start this full time. So when it comes to living a rich life, what will be more effective? Trying desperately to save a few bucks on our morning latte, then rebounding back out of habit, or earning thousands more doing something we already love?
Ramit Sethi is the best-selling author of the book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org/money. College tuition just keeps going up and up and up, and you may be asking yourself just what all that money is going toward.
The important lesson, I think, with this is to simply look at the numbers and then start asking the questions of the institution to understand what the numbers mean and why.
New tools that do the math on college costs later on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is Kathy Kristoff of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Tess.
I wanted to ask you before we launch into our callers about a column that you wrote a couple of weeks ago about something called cramming. And I know that the head of the FCC kind of put out an alert on this.
Yep.
Tell us what it is, first of all.
Cramming is when somebody puts unauthorized charges on your phone bill. So you may not notice them. And in fact, most people who are victims of cramming have no idea because they put these charges on your phone bill and they describe them as service fee, membership. And they're mostly relatively small charges, $1.99, $5.99, $9.99. You just don't think anything of it.
How do they get away with this? I mean, how can they just put charges on there and not have somebody notice?
Years ago, the rules changed so that phone companies could bill you for outside services on your phone bill. It can be for something as innocuous as ringtones, or it could be a membership for a video dating service. The phone companies make money by billing you or allowing them access to your phone bill to bill you. And so they have a vested interest in making you happy. And that's a really important thing to remember, because if you find cramming charges on your phone bill and the actual crammer does not take them off, you call your phone company, because normally they will.
What's the best way to recognize that this is happening to you?
To find it, you have to go through your phone bill on a line-by-line basis. The only tip-off should be that there'll be a phone number next to some charge, because anybody who puts a charge that isn't a phone service on your bill should include their toll-free number for you to question it. And if you don't want to have to check your phone bill on a regular basis, call your phone company and tell them to block outside charges.
Oh.
They'll do that too.
Okay. All right. Well, everybody has homework for this weekend now.
Exactly.
Go over your phone bill and make sure you're not getting crammed. All right. Well, speaking of phone bills, let's head to the phones. And Carlos is with us from Pico Rivera here in California. Hi, Carlos.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you. How was your fourth?
It was very good, and I'm actually just very excited to be done with it and be on the phone with you, actually, to be honest.
Oh, well, hopefully we'll have some fireworks here for you, right?
Definitely.
What do you do there in Pico Rivera?
You know, I'm actually working in Monrovia. I'm an account manager for a software consulting company. I just started, actually, about a couple months ago.
Oh, okay. All right. What did you do for the fourth?
You know, I just pretty much took it easy this weekend.
Yeah.
Since I just started this job, I wanted to go ahead and take these next few months to just kind of save up a little bit and pay off some expenses that I had from, I was actually not working for about 6 months, so I'm trying to pay down a little bit of debt that I had from my time off.
How were those 6 months for you?
You know, luckily for me, I'm pretty financially savvy, so I was able to pretty much weather the storm.
Wow. You had an emergency fund?
I did.
Good for you, Carlos. That's wonderful to have some money set aside, you know, for whatever happens.
Thumbs up.
Yeah.
Well, Carlos, it sounds like you've got everything in hand. How can we help you out?
About a year ago, I opened up a Roth IRA. And at the time with my previous employer, they actually had a fully funded retirement plan. So I didn't have to actually invest in my company's plan. So I just decided to open up a Roth IRA because I had read that, you know, it's just a good idea to have something to complement, you know, your company's plan.
Absolutely.
And so when I was laid off, I just went ahead and I just transferred what I had in that savings plan into my Roth IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all fine and dandy. And at my current employer, they actually don't offer a plan until now that they're actually really thinking about providing one, just administering it, so they wouldn't even be, you know, matching a 401k plan or anything like that. So my question is, should I fully continue to fund my Roth IRA with my post-tax income, or should I take advantage of the 401k plan and use some of that pre-tax income to invest in it? I'm only 25 years old right now.
I would say that typically the answer, you know, is a Roth better or do you invest in the 401k, really has to do with your tax rate. Mm-hmm. So it's how much money you earn and what your marginal tax rate is. So are you saving 28% or are you saving 15%? If you're only saving 15% in taxes, then, you know, it skews to a Roth IRA, because you're so responsible and you're saving so young, you're likely to be really rich when you're old. God bless you. And so you'll get a better savings by, you know, like deferring your tax benefit until you're old. It would skew to the Roth if you're only in the 15% bracket. But if you're in the 28 or 35 or whatever percent bracket, then you say the 401k, that tax benefit up front is worth a lot more. So it really kind of depends on your tax bracket. And one other thing, what choices your employer gives you in terms of investment options, because sometimes 401k plans can be very expensive. And so you have to make sure that they have a, you know, like an index fund option that has a low expense ratio, both on the fund and for the administration of the plan, because most 401k plans pass on the administration costs to you. So you need to watch those fees. And if they're too high, then you invest outside of the 401k.
You know, that's actually really good information. I didn't think about that, because I know that from my Roth IRA has, I think it has like the lowest expense ratios in the industry. So that's why I chose that one.
So yeah.
As far as 401ks, I didn't even consider that.
You know, Kathy, I think we do want to just delineate here that if the 401k had a match, then the answer would be completely different.
Absolutely.
You absolutely would want to go at least up to the match on that. But since this doesn't, it really is a tax bracket question. So does that help you out?
Yeah, definitely. That's a lot of good information. I really appreciate both of your help.
Well, thanks so much for calling, and congratulations on all that you've done so far in your early years to get yourself started.
The new job, the savings. Yeah, good job.
Good for
you.
Well,
thank you very much. And it's actually partly due to the fact that I listen to the show and I'm keeping up to what I should be doing at every stage of my life. So.
Oh, you just made our day. Thanks so much, Carlos.
Thanks for kissing
up. All right, thank you, guys.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, Michael is with us from Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
So what do you do there in Morristown?
I work in New York City as a curriculum developer for an educational publishing company.
What kinds of changes have you found over the years in terms of what's covered and what should be covered and that sort of thing?
So I've been in this business for 3 years. Before that, I was a high school math and science teacher.
So you've gone from being in the school to helping out with the books that are going to go into the school.
With the books and software and stuff that are going to the school. I mean, the movement is toward, you know, accountability in testing.
Right.
Increasingly, there's a push towards common standards for multiple states, particularly in mathematics.
Now, is that something where, I mean, you were a teacher and then you went into a related but a different business. Did you have to go back to school or anything for that?
So I did not. It was about the only thing outside of the classroom that I was qualified for, which is part of how I ended up in the industry. But actually, part of what I'm calling about is that I'm planning to go back to school.
Oh, you are?
Now.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to be leaving my current job to go and accept an offer of admission at a top 5 MBA program.
Now, why head that direction?
It's because an MBA, you know, it'll open a lot of the doors I'm looking for, and it's a sort of a, it's very versatile.
Are you looking to branch out beyond education?
I was a chemistry major in college and did some research in climate issues, so I'm interested in getting involved with the alternative energy movement and economy.
Ah, yes. Well, that's certainly a growing movement.
Yes.
Let me make an educated guess here, Kathy. We might be talking about student loans.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
What are we looking at for school here?
So tuition is $50,000 a year.
That does
not include fees or living expenses.
How many years is the program?
It's a 2-year program. And even taking into account a substantial scholarship, merit scholarship that I was offered, it looks like I'm on the hook for about $65,000 per year.
Do you have any? Have you been saving up for this opportunity, for this career change?
You know, I'm a loyal listener, and I really try to practice what you guys preach. I use credit responsibly. I don't have any debt currently.
Yay!
I save for retirement, and I've also accumulated some emergency fund, and then plus some, you know, short-term savings.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing that will.
but not $130,000 worth.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I have about $35,000 in short-term savings. You know, I'm just sort of looking for how to balance this mountain of debt option and then how I can use my current savings to balance that.
I don't have any, you know, easy answers for you. The thing I would say is borrow as little as you can. Make sure you have some sort of part-time job, which you can still do in MBA school, and use your savings first, or your short-term savings, the $35,000. Look for scholarships. There's a great site called FastWeb. And then borrow judiciously. I would encourage you to just look at the federal student loan program. I know you'll be offered all sorts of private student loans, and they will probably look like a bargain because they're variable rate loans. And right now we're in a uniquely low interest rate environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so those variable rate loans look cheap. But 2 years from now, we don't know what the interest rate environment is, and they have the right to raise rates. It's one thing to take on a debt that you know how big it is. It's another thing to take on a debt that could balloon. And that is unfortunately what a lot of people have found with private loans in the past. And so what you want is you want a borrowing strategy that basically causes you to borrow as late as possible, right? So essentially you want to take your aid and your cash and use that in your first year and then borrow your second year. And so that way you're accumulating interest only for 1 year. You also have a little bit better idea of what interest rates are going to be so that it cuts your risk by not borrowing immediately. You are in a little bit better of a spot.
Okay.
All right. Does that help you out, Michael?
Yes. That's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Well, good luck.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. And finally, we have Nikki in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Nikki.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. What do you do there in Boise?
I am a registered nurse.
Oh, okay. How'd you get into that?
I just was looking for a career that I could be helping people and that I would always could find a job wherever I go.
Yeah, and I think we've heard that over the last several years that nursing is certainly one of the top careers if you want to always be in need.
Yeah.
In high demand.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yep.
Have you lived there in Boise for a while?
We just moved here in January. We relocated hoping to find work for my husband, and I quickly got a job, and he is still looking.
Oh, boy. How long has he been out of work?
About 3 years now.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah.
What does he do?
He has two related fields that he works in. One is aviation, A&P mechanic, and the other one, which he has his degree in, is environmental consulting.
That must be tough. I mean, out of work, that 3 years is a long time.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It has been really tough on him.
So how can we help you out today?
Well, so with our relocation back to Boise, we've been searching for a home.
Are you renting now?
We are.
Okay.
Yeah, and we really want to purchase a home. We've always owned a home, and that's just our way of life, and we want to be comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
So we found one we really like. It happens to be a short sale and possibly soon into a foreclosure. But since my husband's still searching for employment, this house is really kind of at the top of our comfort range for price on one income.
Wow. Okay.
But it is possible?
Yes, very possible.
Yeah. That means you have some savings for a down payment?
We would be putting about 50% down on the home. And then we do also have an emergency savings account. We've been pre-approved for the loan. We have excellent credit, we've been told. We have no other debt. So really the question is, you know, should we be purchasing a home not knowing how much further home prices are going to fall and stress our monthly finances, or should we just, you know, wait until we do have two incomes and we can be completely comfortable?
That's a tough question.
It is a tough question. I guess, you know, my immediate reaction, as wonderful as owning a home is, you know, as soon as you have the phrase, you know, stretch our monthly comfort level, that's a red flag for me. You always are going to be stretching to buy a home, but you don't want to get to the point where it becomes something that weighs on you.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, you're very secure in your job, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the bank has obviously approved you based on your income alone, right?
Right.
So they think you can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is there something more that makes this an uncomfortable decision for you? Or is it just that you're very, very fiscally conservative and want to make sure you're...
That's it. I've, you know, always pretty much been comfortable with my finances and never had to live knowing, okay, how much do I have in my bank account? Can I write this check? Living, you know, paycheck to paycheck. I've never had to deal with that. And I feel like maybe if we went through with this, we would be thinking more like that.
Uh-huh. Nikki, why do you feel like you need to put 50% down to get a loan? Is that purely to get the loan?
Well, just to bring down the payment amount, yeah.
The current state of affairs with real estate is if you want to get a loan and you're on the edge of being able to afford the payment, the bank is much more likely to accept your loan request if you have a really huge down payment. Banks are still very reluctant to lend and take on any big risk. Mm-hmm. And so they essentially want to know that you're taking on as big of a risk as they are. So I would imagine that because you're willing to put down so much, that's why they're willing to lend you the rest. But, you know, really, Nikki, the question you're asking is one that you have to answer. It's, you know, your personal comfort level. A lot of opportunities will come along. They'll all look great at the time. But if they make you really uncomfortable, it's not an opportunity. It's a risk. Mm-hmm. Because what you don't want to do is have a beautiful home that keeps you up at night.
Yep.
You know, and a home, in addition to the monthly payment, you have property taxes, you have insurance, you have repairs. There are a tremendous number of expenses that go along with being a homeowner that can quickly eat up whatever reserve or additional money that you think you have in a month.
Which you know because you've owned homes before, right?
Right. Right.
Stop looking at the house and whether you want to be homeowners in the long run, because you will be homeowners in the long run if that's what you want. What you need to look at is this putting us at personal risk that we're uncomfortable with?
Does that help you out?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or send us an email at the Gooding Personal link on our website. It's marketplace.org. Kathy, thanks so much for coming in. Good to see you.
Thanks, Tess. It's been fun.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
I'm Catherine Varden, and we're here at Organic Harvest in Hoover, Alabama. And I'm going to tell y'all what's in my wallet. I have money. I have a movie receipt. It was The Hangover 2. It was hilarious. I have my license. I just got my license in December. It was awesome. I got it on my 16th birthday, and so much freedom. It was amazing. I have many Walmart receipts. So I love to go shopping at Walmart. I have a Target receipt from today. I brought 3 dresses and a tank top. And cosmetics, and I spent $115.37. There goes my paycheck.
Tell me, can you relate to the new movie, Horrible Bosses?
I had a boss who thought she ran the world and she was against all men.
We'll take the premise seriously, though the movie looks vapid, and have some advice on how to make the best of a tough work environment. Next up, Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Families trying to figure out just how much college is going to cost have some new tools. A website from the U.S. Department of Education lists the cheapest and most expensive colleges in the country. Sitting Bull College in North Dakota gets the prize for lowest price at a public college. The lists aren't just a public outing, though. Schools that jack up their prices the most in the last few years will have some splaining to do to the feds. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott looks behind some of the numbers.
Some of the numbers are eye-popping. Consider Clayton State University in a suburb of Atlanta. Between 2007 and 2009, the public university's net price rose more than 1,500%. Net price is the average cost of attending, minus grants and scholarships.
One could make an assumption that someone is increasing cost through the stratosphere at that institution.
That's John Millsaps with the Georgia Board of Regents. He says that assumption wouldn't be quite right. During the years in question, Clayton State went from being a commuter school with no student housing to one with dorms. So it wasn't tuition, but dorms that pushed the price up.
The important lesson, I think, with this is to simply look at the numbers and then start asking the questions of the institution to understand what the numbers mean and why.
Schools with big net price increases, like Clayton State, or big tuition hikes, like Arizona State, will have to explain those increases to the Department of Education. The idea is to give students and families more information and to shame colleges into lowering prices. Lucy Lipofsky says it's probably not going to work. She's a higher education consultant and former president of Mercy College in New York. Lipofsky says the biggest increases are mostly at state schools,
which increased their tuition in large part as a reaction to significant reductions in state support. They don't have too many alternatives to to maintain their revenue stream.
Another reason some schools jack up their prices is us. Tuition at private Jamestown College in central North Dakota jumped 39% from $11,500 to $16,000 a year. Polly Peterson is vice president for institutional advancement. She says the school raised its tuition to help pay for academic improvements, but also for appearances. Other colleges in the Midwest charge more.
And as we recruit students in that area, we do get that question. Parents will ask, how can you offer the same quality if you're not charging the same prices?
But again, the numbers don't tell the whole story. At the same time Jamestown raised tuition, it increased scholarships. So the actual cost of attending, the net price, went up a lot less. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb teaches education policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She says colleges get away with this because students and their parents let them.
They're not walking away. And what I'm worried about is that maybe students from low-income families will walk away, but the middle class and the upper class, they will continue to purchase it. And so the colleges and universities have very little incentive to do anything else.
Consumers armed with more information might start to fight back. The Department of Education's new website gives some of that information if you're willing to do some digging. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
And if you'd like to do some of that digging, we have a link at marketplace.org. When we decided to do this next interview, it was because of all the news about hackers breaking into the likes of Citigroup and Sony. But the hacking story this week beats them all. Reporters at Rupert Murdoch's British tabloid News of the World are accused of hacking into the voicemail accounts of celebrities, relatives of soldiers killed at war, and even that of a 13-year-old murder victim. So Sunday's edition will be the paper's last. But let's talk about what you can do to protect yourself online and elsewhere. Carmen Wong-Ulrich joins us again. She's a personal finance journalist and author of The Real Cost of Living. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tess. Thanks for having me.
So we've seen a lot of headlines recently about major hacking incidents like Sony, where reportedly the hackers got millions of credit card numbers. How bad is that for us?
Actually, we would think that the credit card hacking is the most dangerous, but almost just as dangerous are just our username and passwords hacking. But here's the thing. So many of us use the same username and password for everything. This spring, there was a study by a security firm. 73% of Americans use the same password and usernames. I know it's hard to keep track of everything, but
it's
especially
totally hard to keep track of everything, which is why I'm one of those 73%. I probably shouldn't admit that on the air, but
no. As of today and speaking to me, you will change your passwords.
Okay.
It's really our first line of defense because there's two ways hackers get in. One, of course, is through the institution themselves, and two is through us. Now, they can get through to us by using our username and password, but also through our own computer. And the easiest way, of course, is for them to strip, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of usernames and passwords from these other organizations and then cross-check that with everything from, you know, Google to your bank.
Mm-hmm.
But on our end, our first line of defense is having a great password and a different password for our banking and our shopping.
You know, for most of us, I think just about our entire lives are online these days, not just credit cards and banking, but, you know, photos and life stories and blogs. Are we at the point where it's kind of accepted that private isn't really private anymore?
I think we can assume a lot of that. But here's the thing. How much do we think before we type or upload photos or use those passwords? I think we do have some control over what's out there. And I think a lot of us maybe take that a little bit either for granted or don't think about it. I really hate when I see on Twitter and Facebook people saying, oh, I'm off to a flight to so-and-so place.
Right.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
It's so easy for someone to get in there, cross-reference your address. It's just too easy. You want to be in very strong control over access to information as to where you are, where you're going to be, and your passwords. I'm just going to keep saying that.
Well, it sounds to me like the best way to avoid all this is to, I guess, write checks, go to your bank, don't bank online, get off Facebook and Twitter, don't use any social media.
No, I got to tell you, banking online to me is it's revolutionary.
I agree.
I'm in the business of trying to help people to save money, manage their money. And there's nothing easier than signing up for like automated savings,
right,
or automated bill pay, that sort of thing. The key is to understand this. Try to do all your banking from one computer.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ever do your banking in a public place where it's public Wi-Fi. If you do your banking on your phone, password protect your phone. The biggest danger is you lose your phone and someone can just get on there,
yep,
and start making transactions. So you got to make sure to password protect everything. But just some of the, you know, basic stopgaps are there. They will protect you. And if they don't on the banking end, that's going to be up to them. And I can tell you, after this Citi breach, the banks are really going to upgrade because they know, for their customers' sake, if the fraud would cost them too much.
All right. Well, if you are a victim, what do you do? What are maybe the first couple of steps?
First is call the credit card company or the bank that has been hacked. Make sure you change your information. Make sure that you fill out the paperwork that they'll give you, either online or in person. You can issue a fraud alert on your accounts. I don't recommend freezing all of your credit because that costs money and it's actually hard to unfreeze it.
Yep.
But just pay attention and look at your statements online. The great thing about banking online is I go in there at least twice or three times a week. Go in there at least once a week. Don't look at your bank statements or your credit card bills once a month. Go in there often and look and see and make sure those charges are legit.
Over a secure Wi-Fi.
One computer over secure Wi-Fi with a different password for your banking.
Okay, I'm going to go change my passwords right now.
Thank you.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and author of The Real Cost of Living. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Anybody going to see that new movie, Horrible Bosses, this weekend? My hand is not up, but here's a preview.
You know, for months you've been hinting that I was in line for that promotion.
And look how hard you've been working.
What, were you just lying to me?
Lying? No, Nick. Motivating. I mean, look, we're all part of the same team here. Plus, you know, I'm the one who's going to be doing all the extra work.
The universal nightmare of working for a bad boss gets the full Hollywood treatment, hitman and all. Most of us just, you know, take it. And here's what some of you told us about your experience with the corner office.
Jeffrey Hayes from New Rochelle, New York. Yes, I've had a bad boss. We hired a new office manager, and she just totally turned the office upside down. I had a run-in with her. She gave me a bad review. And I asked her, does she really know what I do? And she said, no, I don't, and I really don't care. Next thing I know, I'm gone. I was angry at first, but I moved on and got a better job.
Laura Hughes. I live in New Jersey, and I have to commute with the bus. When I was a lot younger, I worked for Verizon, and all the other bosses that I had would let me come in 15 minutes early and leave 15 minutes early due to my bus schedules, and then I got put to another department, and this woman, she just was like, I don't care. I live in New Jersey, too. Deal with it. And she was kind of rough. I was only 19, so I was a little, like, sensitive to her, but besides that, I feel like I've been pretty lucky.
Michael Thompson, I had a boss that was so bad because he used to give us a hard time, always threatening to fire us and everything. So I caught him going to the Jiffy John, and me and a couple of my buddies, we pushed the thing over on him. And you know something? We had no problems with him ever since. He was a real nice boss after that.
My name is Rico Harris. My bad boss experience was when I was in Dallas, Texas. I was working at a club, and my boss would withhold our tip money. And we were supposed to get paid on Friday, but he would hold it until Monday or Tuesday of the following week until he was done using it for what he needed to use it for. We kind of knew something foul was going on, and eventually it came to light, and nothing really happened. He just kind of changed his routine, but I would have to say that was a pretty shicey thing to do, you know?
All right. Well, there are, of course, adult ways to deal with a difficult boss, and Allison Green is here to talk about some of them. She writes the Ask a Manager blog, which tackles workplace and management issues. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Beyond some of the obvious stuff, what is a good way to deal with a bad boss?
I think one of the key elements, no matter what type of boss you have, is no matter what your frustrations are, you want to get really clear in your own mind about what you can and can't control. And if you accept that certain things are just the reality of your boss's working style, then you can focus less on what might be a pretty fruitless battle to try to change her and more on ways that you could work effectively within that context. So to give you an example, let's say that you have a manager who's just really busy and she's pulled in a bunch of different directions and she's always canceling these regular weekly meetings, so you can never get her attention when you need it. So if you accept that that's just the way she is and you're not going to change her, then you can start thinking about what you can do within that context. Hmm. So maybe you start anticipating that she is going to cancel on you. So when you run into her in the hallway, you grab her for a minute and you ask the most important questions you have.
What about if you're faced with a truly terrible person? You know, you hear these nightmare stories that actually aren't far off from what I've seen in the trailers for this movie. You know, aside from going to HR, what other recourse do you have? And at what point does that become mandatory?
You know, I think you have to really be clear on what your own bottom line is. And it's different for everyone. But you've got to step back, take your emotions out of the equation, and try to figure out what you really can and can't live with. And if something that you just hate about your boss isn't going to change, you know, she's just a terrible person or she's crazy, which is something that really happens, then your next step is to decide whether you can find a way to live with that and still be reasonably happy. And if you can't, you're probably better off accepting that so that you can start looking for ways to move on. But a lot of times, if you just accept a bad boss as part of the package, you can find yourself living with it more comfortably. And for instance, maybe you hate your boss, she's a terrible person, but you have a really short commute to work and you love that. You might ultimately decide that you would rather keep that short commute, even if it means that your terrible boss is part of the deal.
And, you know, I guess what is the real complicating factor there is that any boss you have has so much power over your future. And if you've got a bad boss, confronting them is probably not a good idea because they certainly have power over raises and promotions and things like that. How do you deal with that power structure?
It's easily the hardest part of the dynamic. But I do encourage people to speak up if they're unhappy. Try to do it unemotionally. Be smart about it. You want to bring it up at a time when your boss isn't swamped or frazzled or in a bad mood. And you want to think ahead of time about your delivery, not just wing it, the same way that you would want your boss to do if she were raising something sensitive with you.
I'm guessing that you also get some questions from managers. What are they saying about how we should be dealing with them? I mean, I'm sure they all think that they're awesome, but...
They do. I think they're great. No, actually, you know, I think people tend to forget that their boss is human. There are going to be times when she's grouchy or just not doing her job very well or frustrated or frazzled. And some of the letters that I get from bosses show insecurity. They think that their employees hate them, or they're really uncertain about how to handle a tough conversation, or they have someone who's not performing and they're feeling insecure about their ability to turn that around. So I think from the employee side of it, recognizing that your boss is human and you could be in those shoes someday can sometimes give some helpful insight.
Have you ever had a bad boss?
I have had a ton of bad bosses. In fact,
no.
I always tell people that everything that I learned about how to manage well came from watching what not to do.
Well, I've had four workplaces in my life, and two of them I had, let's say, questionable bosses. Of course, my current one is the best boss ever.
I'm sure that's true.
Allison Green writes the blog Ask a Manager, and she's the author of How to Get a Job, Secrets of a Hiring Manager. Thanks so much. It's been fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Fort Collins, Colorado, and a listener named Harlan. He wrote to us this week with a lesson that we try to emphasize over and over on this program. We figured you might be sick of hearing us yammer on about it, so we asked him to tell you himself.
In 1978, I changed jobs, wanted to raid my TIAA CREF account, then about $10,000. I learned I would have penalties and so forth. I left it intact. 30 years later, it has grown to nearly $350,000. I always kept it in the common stock fund. Earnings were reinvested. Had I access to that $10,000, I am sure I would have spent it up with current desires. Instead, it grew remarkably with no direction by me. Try not to disturb your retirement money. years will pass faster than you can ever imagine.
And it worked. Harlan is 64 and retired. But we're pretty sure he's still a good saver. So off with you, little pig. Take a sweater for the winter, because it'll come faster than you can imagine. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. The conversation continues all week long on my Facebook journalist page. Like me and tell us what you want to hear on the show. And of course, follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, in the job market, 20-somethings have youthful exuberance on their side, but they are sorely lacking in one very important skill.
These young people who are coming out of college, they're great with math, or they can code like nobody's business, but you bring them to a business lunch and they have no clue what to do.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Sonata Lee Narcisse. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.